Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to this Federalist Society Teleforum conference call. As today, March 30, 2020, we're having a doctrine briefing on the ministerial exception. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our expert. We're very pleased to be joined this afternoon by Ms. Victoria Dorfman. She's a partner at Jones Day and was involved in filing an amicus brief in last year's case, Our Lady of Guadalupe, which expanded this doctrine that was outlined in an earlier case, Hosanna Tabor v. EEOC. So we're going to get a background of the doctrine, the ministerial exception. We're going to discuss the current implications, the ongoing litigation, and the future of the doctrine. After that, we'll have time for audience questions. So we'll be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. All right, with that, thanks for being with us here, Victoria. I'll hand the floor to you.
Thank you, Nick. Good afternoon, everyone. As Nick said, I'm Victoria Dorfman, partner in Issues and Appeals Group of Jones Day, Washington, D.C. office. And a disclaimer of my own, the views are my own, not of Jones Day. So thank you, everyone, for taking the time to join us to talk about the ministerial exception. What is it? It's a constitutional doctrine having origin in the First Amendment's protection of religious autonomy. And religious autonomy is the right of religious institutions to decide for themselves, free of state interference, matters of church government, as well as those of faith and doctrine. Ministerial exception is a subpart of religious autonomy and applies to laws governing the employment relationship between a religious institution and certain key employees. The bottom line is that it is up to the religious organizations to have control over their key personnel, who cannot sue them for not hiring them or firing them, etc. So this presentation has three parts. First, we are taking a tour into the history of ministerial exception. Second, I'll talk about recent Supreme Court decision. And third, the issues that are already arising and will likely arise post Our Lady. So the Supreme Court issued a seminal decision this past term, Our Lady of Guadalupe. But let's talk first about the history of ministerial exception and religious autonomy. To give you some context about history, in the last several years, I have been counsel of record for a group of professors, the premier experts on the religion clauses, and submitted amicus briefs in course of appeals and the Supreme Court on ministerial exception issues, in support of litigation brought by our outstanding friends and colleagues at the Beckett Fund. Our briefs focused on the history of ministerial exception, and our most extensive foray into this topic was the amicus brief on the merits for Our Lady last term. So a lot of information that I'm going to be discussing here can be found in that brief. Given the format of the teleforum, I'm not going to cite the sources. Rather, I'll tell you about what they say, but you can find the full references to all those events and topics in that brief. So the principle that the government may not interfere with internal church affairs has long meant, among other things, that religious communities and institutions enjoy meaningful autonomy and independence with respect to their governance, teachings, and doctrines. Quoting Professor Borg, it's worth emphasizing that the freedom to select religious leaders was a landmark in the development of limited government in the West, and that freedom resulted from a long and bloody history of conflict between secular and religious authorities. They start in ancient Rome, move on to medieval Europe, then to England, and then to the early U.S. experience, many of you may be more familiar with. So in ancient Rome, religion was an affair of the community as a whole, and there was no form of social life that was wholly secular. For instance, the coins used for currency throughout the Roman Empire depicted the image of the emperor on one side, and liturgical instruments used for offerings and sacrifices on the other. Religion was simply part of the fabric of Roman life, and the idea of an institutional distinction between church and state emerged only in the 2nd century during the persecution of Christians in Rome and Carthage. Tertullian, an early Christian apologist, was the first in the history of Western civilization to use the phrase freedom of religion. Early Christians recognized a so-called dual loyalty to the church and the state, which they would obey, whereby which they would obey the magistrates, princes, and powers on certain matters, while recognizing a separate sphere of authority on matters of religion. Secular leaders gradually came to recognize this distinction as well. Then in medieval Europe, the conflict arose between two swords of church and state, and this conflict resulted in the so-called Papal Revolution. In 1059, Pope Nicholas II, for the first time, forbade lay investiture, thereby taking the power to appoint the Pope away from the Emperor. 16 years later, in the investiture controversy, another Pope, Gregory VII, challenged the authority of kings to invest bishops with the symbols of their office, on the ground that lay investiture threatened the freedom of the Church and inverted the right orderings of Church and society. The state continued to endure a series of conflicts over the government's intervention in religious decision-making. Neither secular nor religious authorities, however, were wholly victorious. Instead, the persistent conflict between them gradually led to a duality of jurisdictions that profoundly influenced the development of Western constitutionalism. In England, perhaps the most famous conflict between secular and religious authorities occurred when Pope Clement VII refused to annul the marriage of King Henry VIII. This incident has been continuing to serve as a fertile ground for books, films, and TV shows. And as we know from those sources, in response, Henry removed the Church of England from the Pope's authority and directed the English clergy to acknowledge the king as the sole protector and supreme head of the English Church. In 1534, Parliament adopted the Act of Succession, which declared Henry's marriage void and annulled, and required the king's subjects to renounce allegiance to any foreign authority or potential. When Henry's Lord Chancellor Thomas More and the Bishop of Rochester, John Fisher, refused to abjure allegiance to Rome, they were both executed. Nevertheless, by the late 16th century, the language of two realms, one spiritual, the other political, had become commonplace. And Catholics in England used this language to defend the Roman Church from persecution. Protestant separatists also invoked this language as they struggled to resist the crown's impositions. Despite the pleas for religious liberty from Catholics and dissident Protestants alike, the crown remained intimately involved in religious governance. From the time of Queen Elizabeth I, the crown maintained control of ecclesiastical affairs by ordaining the clergy, issuing licenses to preach, and overseeing the schools. And after James IV took the throne in 1603, he proclaimed it the chiefest of all kingly duties to settle the affairs of religion. Not surprisingly, religious wars followed. The worst of England's religious struggles were resolved by the Act of Toleration in the wake of what the victors called the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Writing to justify and secure the fruits of that revolution, John Locke penned his influential A Letter Concerning Toleration, advocating church-state separation as the only path toward peace. According to Locke, and I quote, "It is utterly necessary that we draw a precise boundary line between one, the affairs of civil government, and two, the affairs of religion." And that's John Locke, Toleration, from 1690. "Otherwise, there will be, quote, no end to the controversies arising between those who have a concern for men's souls and those who have a care for the commonwealth." Locke insisted that religious institutions must be free to control their membership and internal affairs. Ideas similar to Locke's found expression in American colonies, such as in the Poitiers Tenet of Persecution for Cause of Conscience, by theologian Roger Williams. Now moving to the colonies and early United States. After the American states gained independence, the Congress of the Confederation strongly endorsed the principle of non-interference in internal church governance. In the early 1780s, the French minister to the United States petitioned Congress to approve a Catholic bishop for America. In response, Congress passed a resolution directing Benjamin Franklin, then ambassador to France, to notify the Vatican's representative that, quote, the subject of this application being purely spiritual is without jurisdiction and powers of Congress. So familiar with life under the established Church of England, the founding generation sought to foreclose the possibility of a national church by forbidding the establishment of religion and guaranteeing the free exercise thereof. The religion clauses ensured that the new federal government would have no role in filling ecclesiastical offices. This understanding of the religion clauses was reflected in two events involving James Madison, the leading architect of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. First, after the Louisiana Purchase, John Carroll, the first Roman Catholic bishop in the United States, asked Secretary of State Madison for advice who should be appointed to head the Catholic Church in New Orleans. Madison responded that the selection of religious functionaries is entirely ecclesiastical, and thus the government should not be involved. Interestingly, Madison subsequently wrote a private letter offering his opinion as a private citizen, but when writing in his official capacity, he declined even to express an opinion on whom Carroll should select. Second, in 1811, Congress passed a bill incorporating the Protestant Episcopal Church in Alexandria. President Madison vetoed the bill on the ground that it exceeds the rightful authority to which governments are limited by the essential distinction between civil and religious functions, and violates the Article of the Constitution of the United States, which declares that Congress shall make no law respecting a religious establishment. Madison explained, and I quote, "The bill enacts into and establishes by law sundry rules and proceedings relative purely to the organization and polity of the Church Incorporated, and comprehending even the election and removal of the minister of the same, so that no change could be made therein by the particular society or by the general church of which it is a member and whose authority it recognizes." This episode demonstrates that the principle of non-interference extends beyond the appointment of clergy. It broadly forbids government from interfering in the organization and polity of the church. Thomas Jefferson took the same view. In 1804, the governor of Orleans Territory wrote to Secretary of State Madison to inform him that the local authorities had shut the doors of the parish church in response to a conflict between two priests concerning who was the rightful leader of the congregation. Although the governor was pleased with this manner of handling the dispute, Jefferson, who learned about it from Madison, was not. In a letter to Madison, Jefferson wrote, "It was an error in our officers to shut the doors of the church. The priests must settle their differences in their own way, provided they commit no breach of peace. On our principles, all church discipline is voluntary, and never to be enforced by the public authority." 1804 was a busy year on this topic for Jefferson, because 8 days later, he penned another letter, this time in response to a letter from the Ursuline nuns of New Orleans. In that letter, Jefferson assured the nuns that the Louisiana Purchase and the transfer of control from Catholic France to the United States would not undermine their rights, including their broad right of self-governance and religious liberty. As Jefferson explained, and I quote, "The principles of the Constitution are a sure guarantee to you that your property and rights will be preserved to you sacred and inviolate, and that your institution will be permitted to govern itself according to its voluntary rules without interference from the civil authority." And so this illustrates that Jefferson also saw church-state separation as guaranteeing the autonomy, independence, and freedom of religious organizations, not just churches, but religious schools as well, as his statement affirming institutional autonomy encompasses the freedom of a religious school to select its own leaders. The disestablishment process in the states further confirms the founding generation's understanding that non-interference is vital to religious liberty. Because the original Bill of Rights did not apply to state governments, roughly half of the states maintained established religions after ratification of the First Amendment. And disestablishment occurred on a state-by-state basis, through adoption of state constitutional amendments. Massachusetts being the last to dismantle its local establishments in 1843. Importantly, each of the states that first maintained an establishment and later adopted a state constitutional amendment forbidding establishment of religion adopted at the same time an express provision that all religious societies have an exclusive right to choose their own ministers. And those states included South Carolina, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts. And so with this historical background, let's turn to the latest Supreme Court decision. So Our Lady of Guadalupe versus Morrissey Barrow was consolidated with St. James versus Peel, both coming out of the Ninth Circuit. Our Lady is the second ministerial exception case. The first was in 2012, Hosanna Tabor versus EOC, where the Supreme Court unanimously held that the First Amendment barred a court from entertaining an employment discrimination claim brought by an elementary school teacher, Cheryl Parrish, against the religious school where she taught. Justice Alito, joined by Justice Kagan, wrote one of the concurrences, which was featured prominently in Our Lady, where Justice Alito wrote for the majority. So, ministerial exception, as you probably know, is a misnomer, and the Supreme Court repeatedly acknowledged it. And indeed, all the cases so far, the Supreme Court, were about teachers. Ministerial exception has been recognized by lower courts for over 40 years under various terms, reaffirming again and again that religious organizations have control over the hiring and firing of those propagating their faith. So what did the Supreme Court hold in Our Lady, broadly speaking? It held that the First Amendment protects the right of religious organizations to decide for themselves, free from state interference, matter of church government, as well as those of faith and doctrine. This is what religious autonomy is, and as you already can tell, this has been a recurring theme in this presentation. Ministerial exception is a corollary of religious autonomy and applies to laws governing the employment relationship between the religious institution and certain key employees. So, which jobs within an organization are ministerial? Hosanna Tabor, the first case, laid out four relevant circumstances but did not highlight any as essential. It was title, substance reflected in the title, how plaintiff held herself out, and job duties. The Ninth Circuit applied a rigid test requiring that all factors be met. The Supreme Court in Our Lady said that this approach produced a distorted analysis and reversed. The Supreme Court also explained that simply giving an employee the title of minister is not enough. A quintessential example would be someone who performs clearly janitorial duties at a religious establishment, and if he or she is given the title of a minister, chances are he's not going to be considered a minister by court. But also having the title of minister, if one actually performs ministerial duties, is not a necessary requirement. That is because many religions do not use that title. And that religious pluralism in our society was a significant factor both in Justice Alito and Kagan, key concurrence in Hosanna Tabor, and in the focus on the function here. And so, as Our Lady clarified, the job functions are the key. And I quote, what matters at bottom is what an employee does. And that also comes from Justice Alito and Kagan concurrence in Hosanna Tabor. The examples that the court gave are educating young people in their faith, inculcating its teachings, and training them to live their faith, which is what teachers do and did in the cases the Supreme Court considered. Other examples are performing vital religious duties, duties at the core of the mission of the institution, or of the very reason for the existence of the institution, individuals holding certain important positions with religious institutions. And Hosanna Tabor also said those who preach their beliefs, teach their faith, and carry out their mission. Justice Sotomayor dissented, joined by late Justice Ginsburg. They thought that this formulation is very broad and potentially includes all parents of students because they're involved in education. Of course, this is not how courts have interpreted either before Our Lady nor since. Now, so what are the additional factors that courts would consider in determining someone is a minister within these two exceptions? And the court explained that employment agreements and faculty handbooks are relevant, especially about what they say about the duties and evaluations of those employees. So employees, teachers, for instance, in those cases, were expected to help the schools carry out their religious mission. And teachers were evaluated to ensure that they were fulfilling that responsibility. So what does it mean for organizations which want to make sure that social goods employees are covered by the ministerial exception based on their functions? That means that organizations would benefit from memorializing the employment contracts, internal operating documents and evaluations that an employee performs functions that are essential to carrying out the organization's mission. Another interesting aspect of Our Lady is that it rejected a co-religious requirement over dissent objection. And so a Hindu teacher performing the same function as Maurice Barry did in Our Lady, a Catholic school, they'll still be covered by ministerial exception, even though he's not a Catholic. As discussed during the oral argument and in briefing, it would be impossible to administer the correlationist requirement and would actually entangle courts into probing deeply into who the true adherents of various denominations are. So, for example, is a Reformed Jew of the same religion as an Orthodox Jew? Or Catholics and Protestants of the same religion because they're all Christian. And such a requirement would also penalize minority denominations, which may have difficulties finding and recruiting people of their own faith to teach in schools. Another very important and consequential discussion within the various opinions now relating is the level of deference to religious institutions. Clearly, the majority says there is some deference to institutions' own view of the employee's function. I quote, a religious institution's explanation of the role of such employees in the life of the religion in question is important. And indeed, that's the key factor out of four. And the majority explained, in a country with the religious diversity of the United States, judges cannot be expected to have a complete understanding and appreciation of the role played by every person who performs a particular role in every religious tradition. Notably, Justice Thomas and Gorsuch concurred, they agreed with that explanation, but their conclusion was that courts should defer to religious organizations' good faith claims that a certain employee's position is ministerial. Not surprisingly, the dissent took the opposite view and thought that the courts will be just rubber stamping the religious organization's determination because function, the most important factor, is for the religious organization to explain. The bottom line on this is all agree that the level of deference is significant. And in my view, there is arguably a convergence between the majority and Justice Thomas and Gorsuch concurrence. So the next question is, where does ministerial exception apply? It clearly applies in certain lawsuits under the ADA, ADA, Title VII, and similar statutes. We filed an amicus brief, and our side prevailed in the Third Circuit, which applied it in a contract dispute between a church and its former pastor. Also note that the ministerial exception performs a different function from BFOQ in the ADA in Title VII, and from Section 702 in Title VII. The anti-discrimination statutes contain provisions allowing religious employers to give preference to members of a particular faith in employing individuals to do work connected with their activities. But this is not what ministerial exception is about. As the Supreme Court explained, think of the quintessential case where a church wants to dismiss its minister for poor performance. The church's objection is not that the minister has gone over to some other faith, but that the minister is failing to perform essential functions in a satisfactory manner. Now, the dissent in our leading fought the majority for interpreting ministerial exception as broadly as it can, without regard to the statutory exceptions narrowly tailored to protect religious practice. Interestingly, Justice Breyer at the oral argument questioned why ministerial exception is necessary at all, given the various statutory protections. But of course, ministerial exception is based on the Constitution and cannot be substituted by a patchwork of federal and state statutes, which can be revised at any time. And ultimately, Justice Breyer joined the majority here. So how does the ministerial exception work doctrinally, and how different is it from typical strict scrutiny inquiry under the First Amendment and RFRA, for example? As you all know, under the First Amendment, if a law is neutral and generally applicable, then it is constitutional even if it imposes substantial burden on religious beliefs. That's Employment Division versus Smith, but of course it may be overruled by Fulton, currently pending in the Supreme Court. But under that framework, if a law has exceptions, then arguably the application of that law to religious organizations must satisfy strict scrutiny. That means the law must be the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling governmental interest. This is not how ministerial exception works. On occasion, plaintiffs and some courts try to import Smith into those cases. The Supreme Court and others have not taken the bait. And so, for example, if a plaintiff claims that he was fired by church because of his disability or sexual orientation or age, that claim will be dismissed altogether once a threshold showing is made that he qualifies as a minister. There is no balancing here, unlike under Smith and RFRA, where a religious organization can still theoretically lose if it is determined that there is a compelling government interest and the imposition and exercise of religion is accomplished through the least restrictive means. So we now come to part three of our talk. What are the issues that are arising post our leading? And let's start with the kind of claims that are covered. And first issue is, does the ministerial exception apply to hostile work environment claims? Prior to our leading, the 10th Circuit said yes, 9th Circuit said no, and it seems that the 7th Circuit agreed with the 10th Circuit that ministerial exception precludes such claims. But then recently, a divided panel of the 7th Circuit in Demkevich versus St. Andrew the Apostle Parish held that hostile work environment claims can actually proceed. The Beckett filed a petition for a hearing en banc, which was granted and heard recently. So that's an interesting case, and I'll tell you a bit about it. There, a parish music director considered that he's a ministerial employee, and he first filed a suit based on wrongful termination. The court dismissed it based on ministerial exception. He then repackaged his claims as based on hostile work environment rather than wrongful termination or some other tangible employment action. The panel held that the ministerial exception did not apply and adopted a rigid categorical distinction between discriminatory employment claims based on hostile work environment and those based on firings or other tangible employment actions. Because the allegations there were actually all speech-based, the panel emphasized that the boss of the music director, Reverend Dada, could have chosen to express church doctrine on same-sex marriage or to exercise his supervisory powers in non-abusive ways that would not add up to a hostile work environment. The panel's approach effectively would involve courts in policing how a higher positioned individual in the church hierarchy expresses himself to a subordinate. In its petition for a hearing en banc, the Beckett Fund warned that the panel's decision, if left in place, would eviscerate the ministerial exception by allowing ministers to simply repackage barred discrimination claims as hostile work environment claims. And the idea animating religious autonomy, that religious organizations have control over their ministerial employees, is the same, whether it's at the start and end point, hiring and firing, or during their employment. I filed an amicus brief on behalf of law professors in support of the hearing en banc, and the oral argument took place in February. We are now awaiting the decision. The Sixth Circuit is considering the same issue in Middleton, where a reverend sued the United Church of Christ over the church's treatment of her while she was employed as an ordained minister responsible for planning nationwide youth events. And once an Easter exception was raised by the church, plaintiff also recharacterized her claims as hostile work environment and argued successfully in the district court that a ministerial exception does not apply. And then in Coney case, the district court applied ministerial exception to hostile work environment claims, and it's currently on appeal to the Third Circuit. So second issue, besides hostile work environment claims, what about ministerial exception and certain tours? Surely everybody concedes religious organizations are not immune from all tort actions, but in certain circumstances, is dismissal appropriate where, for instance, it is a challenge to ministerial employment decisions or internal church governance? This is subject to cert petition in North American Mission Board versus McCraney. The question there is whether ministerial exception applies only in the context of employment law claims, or are religious employers protected even when a challenge to a minister's termination is framed as a tort? The case involves two Southern Baptist organizations who partner together and share their faith. A leader of one of the organizations expressed disagreement with how the groups were partnering together. After being removed from his leadership position at one organization, he brought a lawsuit aimed at the other. The lawsuit was framed as a tort action involving claims such as intentional interference with his business relationships, namely his previous employment. Resolving those claims would require courts to scrutinize why a religious employer removed a minister from his position, an inquiry that by now should be clear forbidden under the Supreme Court's ministerial exception cases. And so there is currently a split in authority about whether ministerial exception extends to torts where there is a causal connection between the allegedly tortious conduct and the termination of ministerial employment. Before filing a cert petition, the North American Mission Board sought en banc review before the Fifth Circuit, which declined it, though the vote was very close, 9-8, with a couple of noteworthy dissents. Judge James Ho, joined by five judges, wrote, "If a religious liberty under our Constitution means anything, it surely means at least this much, that the government may not interfere in an internal dispute over who should lead the church, and especially not when the dispute is due to conflicting visions about the growth of the church." Similarly, Judge Andrew Odom, joined by four judges, noted his opinion that this case is rich with questions of exceptional importance, including the application of the church autonomy doctrine to certain torts. We will see what the Supreme Court does. Interestingly, respondent initially waived its opposition, but then the Supreme Court requested response to the cert petition, and it's due later in the spring. Moving on to the procedural aspects, note that another interesting aspect of ministerial exception is the nature of this protection. In a footnote in Hosanna Tabor, the Supreme Court said it's an affirmative defense and it's non-jurisdictional. Now, at least several courts of appeals, such as 3rd, 6th, and 7th circuits, have said that ministerial exception is structural and that it's not waived if a religious organization fails to raise it, rather than when district court raises it sua sponte. That's because the exception has two functions. It protects the church's own right to autonomy with respect to the selection of the individuals who play certain key roles. But also the exception is rooted in constitutional limits on judicial authority, preventing it from getting embroiled in religious controversies. And indeed, taking our later opinion at face value about courts not having authority to interfere in internal affairs of religious organizations, it appears to be more than merely an affirmative defense. So the other procedural issue is discovery. Notably, post-Hosanna Tabor, courts have appropriately held that ministerial exception issue should be determined before allowing discovery into the merits of the claims. That is because unnecessary merits discovery creates the very type of intrusion the ministerial exception seeks to avoid. And so courts explained that making discovery process its itself is a First Amendment violation. Likewise, courts have quashed subpoenas where they implicated or violated church autonomy rights. That said, some discoveries allowed, such as to resolve factual disputes about ministerial exception itself. And courts delay merits discovery until the threshold issue is resolved. Courts have also permitted discovery into other claims that would be unaffected by the ministerial exception. And in this sense, the court's approach is similar to that for discovery related to jurisdictional challenges under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 12b1. Since what's on the table, and we expect this to continue, courts have treated ministerial exception arguments as suitable for interlocutory appeals under the collateral order doctrine. As you remember from Cohen, it permits interlocutory appeal of prejudgment orders that conclusively determine the appealed issue, are collateral to the merits of the action of an action, and are too important to be denied immediate review, and would be effectively unreviewable on appeal from a final judgment. In the case of ministerial exception, as the Seventh Circuit explained, the First Amendment rule against judicial interference in internal religious affairs was closely akin to a type of official immunity, since it conferred immunity from the tribunal of a trial and not just from an adverse judgment. Thus, the harm of such governmental intrusion into religious affairs would be irreparable, just as the other types of cases in which collateral order doctrine allows interlocutory appeals. Now, looking beyond ministerial exception, what can we expect based on the broad language in our lading? It certainly goes beyond internal management decisions. And the broad umbrella for what is protected by the religious clauses is best seen through the prism of religious autonomy. As the Supreme Court explained, that includes the right to decide matters of faith and doctrine, matters of church government, work at the core of a religious organization's mission, where judicial review of how religious organizations discharge those responsibilities would undermine the organization's independence. And that there are other matters that are component of religious autonomy. The examples Supreme Court gives are control of property and appointment and authority of bishops. And in addition to this precedence, the Supreme Court said they look to the background against which the First Amendment was adopted. And that was the subject of our amicus brief. So if at the time of the adoption of the First Amendment, some aspect of religious organizations' function was protected from governmental interference, it will also likely be protected today. And so one example that comes to mind beyond employment litigation or breach of contract litigation is bankruptcy. For instance, how should courts treat church internal structure and transfers in bankruptcy if a religious organization says that particular arrangement is an essential part of church governance and is dictated by its faith and doctrine? Another example is abuse litigation against various religious entities. As you know, many dioceses around the country have been sued by plaintiffs alleging they were abused by priests, parish school teachers, or church volunteers, and their theories range from intentional torts, such as assault and battery against accused individuals, to theories of respondeat superior to hold the religious entity itself responsible for those acts of negligent hiring, and supervision against religious entities. So the question is, if a religious organization has subsidiaries and affiliates, which entity is responsible for the misconduct of which employees? Is the diocese responsible for a parish school teacher's misconduct over students? And in connection to that, I'll talk very briefly about another Supreme Court decision, Roman Catholic Archdiocese of San Juan versus Feliciano. It's a per curiam opinion with a notable concurrence and a thought-provoking Solicitor General's brief. The case arose when a pension fund for a Catholic school in Puerto Rico stopped making payments. Teachers sued the fund and also the Archdiocese of Puerto Rico and the Catholic Church there. Puerto Rico courts treated all of the Catholic institutions on the entire island, the Archdiocese, the diocese that comprised the diocese, and the parishes as one legal entity. And the court ordered nearly $5 million in assets to be seized from the churches to pay the pensions. court held that Puerto Rico court wants jurisdiction to enter certain orders. But it was Justice Alito and Thomas's concurrence that spoke about the incorrect interpretation by Puerto Rico courts of whether the Catholic Church there was a single entity. And more importantly, about deference to religious organizations on understanding of their structure. And if you recall, deference was certainly a much debated topic within the opinions in our lady. And that is relevant, for example, to whether a diocese is liable for various entities that are loosely associated with it and the conduct of employees of those entities. Do note, however, that the Solicitor General's amicus brief in that case points out the obvious exceptions to corporate separateness, such as agency, joint and several liability, and veil piercing. And it's not clear under current case law how those interact with the religious organization's own understanding of its structure. And so the key issue likely litigated in this domain is to what extent those exceptions to corporate separateness override the religious organization's own understanding of its structure. And the decision Our Lady may have impact on that, both because it mandates some deference and because it tells courts to respect and not interfere in matters of church government. And of course, Fulton versus Philadelphia may also bear on this issue, as it may overrule employment division versus Smith and neutral principles line of jurisprudence. And so, in sum, there are many issues that will be impacted by these decisions beyond those that were obviously at stake in Our Lady. And that's it for my presentation, and happy to take any questions.
Thanks so much, Victoria. Seeing no questions right now, Victoria, I'll go ahead and ask the first one while people are lining up. Could you talk a little bit about the interaction between this doctrine, the ministerial exception, and the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, perhaps in the realm of school choice, parental choice, things like that?
They both obviously have to do with the First Amendment religious clauses, but I'm not sure there is necessarily a direct overlap between the two to the extent that both at bottom depend on recognition of religious autonomy. And so they both come more or less from the same source. But I think the ministerial exception has been used by courts more about control over personnel rather than the questions that are raised in unconstitutional conditions.
Okay, yeah, just a question that's come up. So Victoria, we don't have any questions right now. We might wrap up a bit early, but maybe if you wanted to add anything else that you didn't cover, or you mentioned the Fulton case at the end, that'll be an important case, ruling coming down this term. I don't know if you want to expand on that a little bit.
The issue in Fulton, one of the issues in Fulton is whether employment division versus Smith should be overruled. And that case has come under much fire from all directions and various justices and courts because the interpretation of what it really means, that law is neutral and generally applicable, has confused various circuits and state courts in a variety of ways. And so based on the oral argument, it's not entirely clear that the court will reach that issue. There are other grounds on which the court may rule. But I strongly suspect that once the Supreme Court recognized that Smith may not be the best way to approach many of the First Amendment religion clause questions, that it will eventually take up some case that will present it in a clean manner. Because, again, Smith has created so much confusion in courts and there is no consistency as to how courts evaluate various statutory or regulatory frameworks that have certain types of exceptions for secular organizations or for certain religious organizations. And it needs to be dissolved in a different manner.
In the meantime, we've gotten two audience questions. So we'll go to our first one.
Hi, Victoria. Thank you so much for this presentation. One of the things I was curious for your thoughts on was you know, in Justice Alito's concurrence in Hosanna Tabor, he emphasizes the importance of not getting hung up on the label minister in ministerial exception. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of takes it another step in the Our Lady opinion, where he says, calls it the so-called ministerial exception. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that's so important and what he's trying to communicate with that?
Well, thank you for joining us and for this excellent question. As I mentioned in the presentation, what Justice Alito and the Supreme Court is recognizing is the amazing diversity of religious experiences in the United States. So whereas minister is a commonly understood term in certain, you know, Christian denominations, it has no equivalency as one particular title in many religious traditions in the United States. And one of the things I don't remember which brief pointed out, I think Beckett Fund's brief on the merits, is like a rabbi, for instance, typically is thought is similar to minister, but in reality just means a teacher. And so during the debate in the Supreme Court and Our Lady as to whether teachers qualify, well, you know, in some religious traditions, being a teacher is more or less viewed the same as being a minister. And so that's the important part. That's why one needs to focus on the functions of what an employee does, whether he or she is transmitting the faith, teaching the faith within that tradition. And it also addresses the concern that I think many have about organizations just giving people a title, such as minister, that has absolutely nothing to do with their functions, and thereby trying to avoid the reach of various anti-discrimination laws or other restrictions. And so I really do think that the approach of the Supreme Court focusing on function takes into account and reflects the realities of American religious tradition and the current diversity of what's presented in the United States.
Thanks very much. Now we'll go to our next question. Okay, caller, go right ahead with your question.
thank you. Given that this ministerial exception doctrine arises out of the First Amendment, is it fair to say that state courts are bound by the procedural aspects of the Supreme Court doctrine? And what I mean by that is, do state courts have to treat it as an affirmative defense and not jurisdictional? Do they have to ban discovery? Do they have to allow an interlocutory appeal and so on? All those nuances that derive from the Supreme Court precedent that may or may not apply to state courts.
Thank you. That's a great question. So first, to be clear, the only thing the Supreme Court has said explicitly about the procedural aspect is that it's an affirmative defense. It's not jurisdictional. And that's Hosanna Tabor footnote. Courts have interpreted that both before and after Hosanna Tabor, have interpreted the necessary exception to bar, as we discussed, you know, certain discovery, allowing through interlocutory appeals, etc. And yes, I believe that is correct, that state courts are bound by those, are bound to interpret their own procedural rules in such a way as not to run afoul of the First Amendment. And it can manifest itself in a variety of ways, as we discussed, whether it's in discovery or appeals or, you know, being able to raise ministerial exceptions to a sponte rather than waiting for parties if they somehow set on their rights. So, yes, I believe that's correct.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and we don't have any questions in the queue right now. With that, seeing about 8 minutes left in our time today, Victoria, I'll offer you the chance for closing remarks. If a question comes up, I'll let you know.
I just wanted to say thanks again for the Federalist Society for the opportunity to talk about this important issue, and also special thanks to my friends and colleagues at the Beckett Fund, since we have litigated, now litigating those ministerial exception cases together for many years now, and trying to ensure that courts come out the correct way, consistent with the history and the understanding of the First Amendment. And thanks everyone for your attention and your questions.
Well, thanks very much, Victoria. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise this afternoon. Also, thank you to our audience for calling in, your good questions. As a reminder, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Also, be keeping an eye on your emails and our website for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls. We've got some coverage this week of Supreme Court oral arguments, so be sure to check out on our website when we're having those. Thank you all for joining us today, and until the next one, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.